الحمد لله الحمد لله وكفى وسلام على عباده الذين اصطفى أما بعد اللهم صل على سيدنا محمد وعلى آل سيدنا محمد وبارك وسلم اللهم صل على سيدنا محمد وعلى آل سيدنا محمد وبارك وسلم اللهم صل على سيدنا محمد وعلى آل سيدنا محمد وبارك وسلم. There is a very famous scholar of the Devandi tradition and very great master of the tasawwuf, Maulana Ashraf Ali Thanwi rahimullah, who he lived from around the late or mid 1800s to about the mid, so-called mid-1900s, roughly speaking. And he had a lot of contributions, a lot of writings, and people would actually, after him, he was such an accomplished sheikh, you could say, in one sense, that he would give ijaza in all of the different turuq. And so I was perusing one of his works, which is Road to Allah, earlier today, and came across a very interesting section. But I guess before that, it's sort of interesting that, I don't know if it was today or yesterday, we were sitting at the dining room table. I think it was this morning, and my son, he asked me, he said, Dad, who's your role model? And then my daughter also asked me, "Yeah, who's your role model?" But it has to be someone who's living, like someone who you aspire to be like. So anyway, that was sort of a discussion, and then we were just going around and asking each other, "Who's your role model?" And this and that, and it's sometimes very hard to find someone that you can hold in that much esteem and benefit from. There wasn't a lot of names that that were pulled out of the hat, so to speak, in having that discussion. And so when you live in that type of, I think we live in that type of context, where there's a lot of factors which are involved. Sometimes there's not that many individuals which are accomplished, there's not that many people who are accomplished that we necessarily have access to, and then there's different other type of hurdles. Then the question is, how do you really, benefit from people of the deen? And this becomes a question which is particularly poignant for women, and that's what I wanted to actually talk about today, because if people are having a hard time, picking out, I think just like casually, people have a hard time picking out scholars, male scholars that they would, want to pattern themselves after or follow. The question becomes even more difficult for sisters. Like, who are the sisters that the sisters look up to and want to follow and want to be like? And there's not a lot of names that come to the table. So then the issue, and the reason that this is particularly important is that in that book, Road to Allah, Mawla Ashraf Ali Thanwi, he basically starts a discussion of like, how do you become kamil? How do you become, how do you perfect yourself and perfect your character? And he gives a very simple answer. He said it's basically by staying in the company of those who are accomplished. You find pious, religious, godly, saintly individuals, and you keep their company, and you benefit, and you learn from them. And eventually that, by osmosis and other methodologies, those characteristics come into the individual, and then they reform themselves. So very sort of that whole idea of suhbah, really. But then he raises the question, he said that, this is for men, then what's a woman to do? And so he says, let's think about this logically. And it was actually was one of the things that I was very impressed with, was how systematically he approached the question. So he said that you know, either the situation is that she will have to go to a mahram, or she's going to go to a non-mahram and, you know, and benefit from them. And he says the problem with her going to a non-mahram is that she can't have the same type of interactions that a man would have with another man. You know, they can't be the same congeniality. There's not the same openness. There's a certain level of formality. And most importantly, there's, you know, there's part of that. There's a hijab that exists in terms of their interactions. So, you know, they don't freely mix with each other. And he said that that congeniality and those intangibles are actually part of the, you know, they're sort of important. And they actually go into the mix in a person bettering themselves. So that category is perhaps not, they're not able to benefit from it in the same way that men are able to benefit from it, right? They're not going to be able to sit in front of the teacher. And that makes a difference. You know, they're not sitting in the same majlis. They're not, you know, sitting there having conversations. They're not, you know, having long conversations. You know, it's sitting with the sheikh in itikaf. So there's a certain level of distance, and because of that, they're not able to fully benefit from that. And particularly, you know, in this time where there's, you know, some, many examples, perhaps, or certain examples of male teachers who've, you know, sort of crossed the line and acted in an indecorous manner with the opposite gender, you sort of almost see this, you know, a very conservative approach from some of the mashayikh now, that you know, like, you should have no female students and let them just benefit. I mean, I know a very prominent sheikh in tasawwuf, probably one of the most senior people, one very senior Sufi sheikhs, and he said, you know, in this day and age, he said, just let the woman just benefit from her husband, and you that's where her benefit is, and, you know, she doesn't need to go to a sheikh, type of thing. And I see where that comes from. It comes from a place of, you know, being careful, and, you know, there's more than one story of things going awry, and, you know, the first principle is that you don't want to do any harm in the process of trying to gain additional benefit, which at the end, right, this is all nafil. This is optional benefit, you know, getting closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's not, I mean, it's optional in the sense that, yeah, I mean, it's not mandated. We know what's necessary, which is that you have to pray your five, and you have to fast your Ramadan, and you have to stay away from haram. And yes, there are some spiritual diseases where it's necessary to remove those. But by and large, you know, a lot of this is, you know, the perfection of a person's character and, you know, reaching this very close station with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and all of these things. This is a supererogatory endeavor, in essence. So in the process, you know, if there's a harm of, you know, some real harm that could potentially happen, then what's a person to do? And so you'll see in certain mashayikh, you know, there's retracting or retreating, if you will, you know, not answering emails, just sometimes being more aloof and slow, you know, just letting sort of people just stray away, or then sometimes being more direct and saying, hey, that you should just go X, Y, and Z place. Some people have just given away all their students. So you have, you know, different people who've reacted in different ways. So he addresses that very thing. So he said the other option for, and, you know, this is like more than a century ago that he's writing about this. He says the other option is that, you know, she can just go to a family member. But the problem is that, and this is sort of the same thing that they came to mind, is that not everyone's family member, not everyone's husband, not everyone's father is going to be a buzurg. They're not going to be a hazrat. Not everyone's going to be alim. Not everyone's going to be super pious. And just dealing with people, I could, you know, sort of see how sometimes you're doing more harm than good, putting them fully into the hands of a person who's not, you know, trained to lead other individuals spiritually. Although they should be, right? That is sort of the responsibility of the husband, to be the spiritual shepherd of the home. He should lead by example. He should, but you know, you do have examples of, you know, men sometimes being very far from the deen and women, you know, trying to hold on to the deen. I remember there's this one sister, subhanAllah, she wants to do an alim course, and you know, her husband is very educated, professional, so on and so forth, but you know, he would have nothing of her to study deen and ilm. So she would actually hide, you know, from him, hide her papers so that he doesn't find it, secretly study the deen. You know, it's like, you know, running away from an oppressive communist government that's going to crack down on you, because otherwise it would just be, you know, there'd be hell to pay type of thing. So, you know, we have real situations like that. So, you know, you're going to tell someone like that, that, you know, make your husband your, you know, your spiritual mentor. I mean, that can lead to serious problems. And especially when there's some people who are already very big in the head, and then you give them more power and say, now you're doing this, then that can become even more worrisome. And this is something that you're not even seeing just with people without ilm. You know, there's even people sometimes with ilm using that position, or misusing, I should say, that position to rationalize things which are clearly not permissible in the deen. You know, one recent case came up where this individual said, well, you know, yeah, I know it's not, this is not okay for everyone else, but it's okay for us because, you know, I'm basically a scholar, so for us it's okay. But, and, you know, there's no two set of rules, like one for mashayikh and ulama and Sufis, and one for the rest of the ummah. It doesn't work like that. And the Prophet ﷺ made this very clear, the idea of justice, that, you know, even if his own daughter Fatima radiallahu anha were to see, he would cut her hand. I mean, the law is blind. You don't get a pass because of, you know, X, Y, and Z. So he says that if you say that she should go to a family member, then that becomes problematic, because they might not be necessarily trained at that level. But then what if, you know, what if there is that situation where the person, well, let's take a step back. So now, say you can't go to a family member. Now you have two choices, right? You can either, or say you do have a family member who is accomplished, who's scholar, who's pious, so on and so forth. Or the other option he mentions is that you could go to a sister, right? And trying to find a sister that is a role model and someone that you can spend time with and learn from and benefit. So then there's issues sometimes. Then he raises issues with both of those possibilities as well. So in that scenario, it's men would basically go and benefit from other men, and women would go and benefit from other buzurg women, and that's the way they would go. So in the situation, let's take the first scenario. So a woman does have a mahram who is, you know, very a real role model in the deen, and, you know, that could guide someone and have the knowledge to do that. He says, even, and this is like 100 years ago, he says the problem with that is that many times the husband is, in the word that he uses, is a slave to the wife. And this often happens because when a person really gets a lot of deen in them, they're very nice, they're very kind, they're very soft, they're very, you know, gentle with their family. And so it's very hard when you have that type of dynamic for the woman to be sort of under the man, because oftentimes it actually does happen. He says either that the man is following the wife. So this is like pre-feminism movement, all of that. This is just sort of how life was like. And either that, or he said they're equals. And so it wasn't very common for a woman to show the honor and respect to the husband that was required, that you would show it like a murabbi or a spiritual mentor. Because at the end of the day, it's your husband. It's not your you know, it's not your sheikh. And without that sort of formalism in some ways, and that respect and that deference, what's that called? A lot of the benefit gets lost. And that was one of the reasons why Mufti Shafi didn't want Mufti Taqi and Mufti Rafi to take bayah with him. Because he said that, well, two things. He said, you know, we have too much of a, you know, an informal relationship, and that's not beneficial along this path. And it's that informalness that at a certain level you can benefit from, right? That you sit with them, so on and so forth. But being too informal, then a person doesn't have that same regard. You know, the words of the sheikh need to have a sort of that impact that, you know, they said that and the person takes it seriously and takes it to heart. And the other issue also here is that, you know, and this is the nature of the relationship, because you're mixing and matching different relationships. It's like, you know, it's like the mom being the homeschool teacher. Is it possible? Yes, technically it's possible, but oftentimes it becomes very confusing for the child because mom is mom, and it's not necessary. It's very hard for them to see her as a teacher at the same time, and then she gets mad, and then that spoils the relationship with her as a mother, and then, you know, it just becomes sometimes a hot mess. So it's the same thing. Like you're blending two different, you know, like if you're a murabbi and you see, you know, arrogance or something like that, and, you know, you're sometimes maybe very stern, and what if he just, you know, gives her a dose of harsh medicine? This is the same person that you need to come home and have, you know, dinner with. It's, I mean, it's awkward, it's weird, and it can be difficult. And then the second thing that he issues is states is that oftentimes, you know, the sister won't see the husband in the same light that she would see as a third person. And it just, this doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter how accomplished that the person is. This is just sort of the nature of, again, just the nature of the relationship. Is sometimes we look, when we look outside, I know in Urdu we say like, har ki murghi dal barabar, you know, you end up taking for granted and not having as much stars in your eyes about those people who are close to you and you're just used to, and it doesn't have the same impact. And he gives a very nice example about, you know, Haji Imdadullah, who was actually the Sheikh Umar Rashid Ahmed Gangohi. So, you know, Haji Saab, his wife, she was actually very obedient to him. And, you know, they had a great relationship, whatnot, and she, and this was Haji Imdadullah, right, which is one of the greatest mashayikh in the Devandi tradition in terms of tasawwuf. And when she wanted to take bay'ah, she said, I want to go and give bay'ah to Mawlana Rashid Ahmed Gangohi, who was a great scholar, right? Haji Saab was not a scholar, Mawlana Rashid Ahmed Gangohi was a great scholar and had tremendous amount of knowledge of Qur'an and so on and so forth. And I believe it was Mawlana Rashid Ahmad. They said that, you know, you're such a great alim. Why did you become bait with Haji Saab? And he said that, you know, I was alim bi kitabillah, and Haji Saab is alim billah. That he knows, I knew the book of God, but he knew God. So that's why he connected with him. There's something special. So she actually went and asked Mawlana Rashid Ahmad, she said, I want to become bay'ah with you. And he's like, why, how, he didn't know what to say. That was his own sheikh, you know, and he said, how can you become bait with me when Haji Saab is there? And she's like, there's no doubt, you know, that he's a great wali and all of that, but, you know, a great elder and saintly person, but he's like, I don't want to be bait with him, I want to be bait with you. And whether or not he ever took her bayah or not, right, that's not necessarily, we don't, his, clearly no, I guess, historically, if that ended up happening. But clearly an example of, you know, a woman not necessarily seeing someone who she acknowledges is a great person, but she didn't see her spiritual benefit necessarily coming from that individual. Another very classical example of this is the mother of Imam Abu Hanifa, that when she wanted to ask a question, she would ask Imam Abu Hanifa. She would say, oh, take me to such and such person. And he would actually take his mother there so she could ask him the question that he knew the answer for, and then, you know, and bring her back. And so you have that dynamic also at play. And when I mentioned the story about her wanting to take bay'ah, right, with Mulan Rashid Ahmed, that also goes to show that, I mean, and the fatwa is that it is permissible for a woman to take bay'ah with a sheikh. I mean, obviously, observing the rules of hijab, and, you know, there can be no inappropriate behavior, and keeping it formal, because there is a need, there's a spiritual need, and, you know, not the deen realizes that. That's why, I mean, it's not a question of it from a fiqh perspective, it's permissible. It's just from a hikmah perspective, and given the circumstances of the time and the fitness of the time, that's why a lot of people are thinking about this whole issue about what is the best advice to give to people in this situation. And sometimes, you know, we find the answer by not, you know, brainstorming forward, but really just going back to our Qabr and just looking at some of their advices and benefiting from that. So that's sort of where this talk is coming from. And so now what are we left with, right? What are we left with? And we're left with a woman benefiting from other women. So that's a possibility, right? And it's not that accomplished women didn't exist, right? You've had a very accomplished women scholars, muhaddithat, were very accomplished saintly women in the Islamic tradition, like Rabi'a Adawiya, right, is probably one of the most famous names in the tasawwuf. But Ibn Arabi, you know, even he, I read somewhere that, you know, he writes about other, some of the women of the time and their, their spirituality and how pious they were, particularly two individuals I think he mentioned. I think one of them was Fatima of Baghdad. So there, and she was an elderly woman. She was like, you know, some 95 years of age or something. So these were, you know, righteous, pious people. And in fact, even Haji Saab himself, you know, his second wife, was, they say that there was no difference between Haji Imdadullah and the second wife. The only difference was that he was a male and she was a female. And, you know, she had a very deep understanding of the Mathnawi. She was just a very spiritual woman. So this is something which door that is, you know, still that is still open, right? If a person is fortunate enough to find someone who has inculcated the deen in themselves to that extent, and that's the easiest situation, that a woman can benefit from another woman. And there's both pros and cons to that, but one of the benefits from that, one of the several benefits, number one, there's no, you don't have to deal with the whole hijab issue, right? So it's much easier communication, you get that informal benefit, they're much more easier for them to spend time. And the second thing is, or the third thing is that it's a woman can understand sometimes another woman in a way that a man cannot. So sometimes a woman is saying one thing, but she means something else. And sometimes women have a much more uncanny ability to read between the lines and really address the issue of what's really going on, because either they've been through that themselves, or they understand it, or from understanding just, you know, human psychology. There are obviously some, you know, there could be some cons as well, but there's definitely a lot of benefits, and that's a very safe, you know, route if a person is able to find that. And, you know, a person doesn't have to be necessarily perfect. You know, no one's perfect. Even the men are not perfect, and women are not going to be perfect. But if a person finds an individual that, you know, that they can trust and that the ulama hold in good regard, and they feel that this person is capable of training other individuals, and that not only can they trust them and they're capable and they're properly trained themselves, then obviously this is a good situation. One of the difficulties why this hasn't really been a very widespread thing, I think historically, is part of it is just biology. Like, you know, women would have children and they had, you know, domestic responsibilities, and because of that, even women who are very, very pious didn't necessarily have a lot of bandwidth to give, you know, spend a lot of time outside. But that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. And when that's not the case, then a person should, you know, take benefit from that. That's what I was saying. The person doesn't have to be perfect, but if you see that this is a person, when I spend their sohbah, I start correcting myself. You remind me of Allah. I'm improving myself. Even that in this day and age is enough for a person to try to capitalize on that relationship. But Mawlana Shafi'i Thanwi doesn't take the discussion in that situation. He actually goes to a different direction, and he first quoting one of the poems of Rumi that basically, when the sun has set, you suffice with the lamp, and then when the flowers are gone, and the bloom is over, that you take from their essence. And what he meant by that is that, you know, when you don't have direct access, you still have access to the writings of the elders, of people who've come past. You have access, especially now with technology, to the lectures, to their mawa'iz, their admonitions. And so taking virtual benefit, really, I think, you know, especially in this day and age of COVID, we can really relate with that idea of taking virtual benefit. He said that that can be as powerful. That can be as powerful as having the real sohbah, the individual themselves. And there's benefits from that as well. You know, I think, you know, when you read about someone in a book, you see something, their thoughts are much more distilled, much more well thought out. And so what you get is really the nichur, the real maghaz, the real crux of the things that they've benefited. And I know, like, sometimes when I write something, you know, I think about it much more than, for example, I'm just sitting and having a casual conversation with other individuals. So you're able to really get very impactful principles and benefit from that. And then, so that's one advantage. And reading about their stories, reading about their lives. You know, there's this one sister who I know went very far in her tasawwuf. There was two books that were, you could probably say, the turning points in her life. The first book was Ar-Rahiq al-Makhtum, right, which is the Seal Nectar, one of the very famous biographies of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. And the second one was Aap Beti, right, which is the autobiography of Mawlana Zakariya, if I'm not mistaken. And going through that and just reading about him and who he was as a person. And that's what sort of, it comes back to what I told my kids earlier today. Like, when it comes to, like, role models, I didn't have a lot of names that I mentioned. I won't say who I mentioned, but I said that, you know, a lot of it is really the elders that I know about through stories. Like, those are my heroes. That's what's inspired me in so many ways. And, I had a student. These things go a long way, right? I had a student who I was impressed with was the amount of talab he had for ulama and tasawwuf and all of these things, even though he grew up in a very, I think, Salafi environment. And I was like, where did you get this? Like, how did you come to this? And he said, oh, you know, when I used to be small, my mother would read, you know, the stories of the mashayikh, like Junaid Baghdadi and all of these, and that formed his core, that formed his root. People need people to believe in. People need people to look up to. That's why it's so important for us to know the seerah. It's so important for us to go through something like Hayat al-Sahaba, because, you know, we hear about these names like Umar radiallahu anhu, Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu, but you have to really know them, right? Just reading some of their words, how they used to think, how they replied to certain situations, that goes a long way. So, and then I'll just end with, you know, with a caveat. I'm not necessarily saying that, no, we should throw away, no one should, you know, have any connection with scholars, and we should just, you know, read books about our elders, and, you know, there's too much times of fitna, and take your goats and live in a cave. No, I think there's actually difficulties and problems with just sticking with the books as well. And one of those things is actually context. I can't tell you how many times, you know, people read sometimes very advanced books of the tasawwuf, people read very advanced books even in ilm. And without a teacher, understanding sometimes to take from that is so off-kilter. It can actually be extremely destructive in the deen, and shaitan can actually leverage that to really, rip so many benefits that person would otherwise have had. Sometimes it creates doubt in a person. Sometimes it creates a wrong understanding when they're trying to synthesize these things. Because the difficulty is when a person is doing that as a student, you don't have the whole, you don't have the scaffold. You don't have the whole picture. So you don't know exactly where to place it information. And so all of it is synthesis. And that's the benefit of someone who's already sort of traveled the path and looking back, because hindsight is 20/20, right? They've made those mistakes. And that's why we have sanad. That's why we have a tradition of teachers. And you know that will continue and always continue. My personal advice is that, you know, I don't necessarily advocate that a person should just, you know, read by themselves and not look for a teacher. But I think that the optimal situation is, you know, if a sister can find, you know, a righteous woman scholar that she can, you know, talk to, discuss these issues with, and also benefit from virtually from the other bayanat of other mashayikh, from their works and all of that, and then have, you know, when issues come up with themselves, particularly spiritual issues, you know, I'm dealing with hasad for such and such individual, they can email that individual. Then, you know, that can be very beneficial. And if a person, you know, cannot find any sister, then I think there's still a place, you know, within the realm of hijab, keeping it not like the sheikh as a life coach, but really as a spiritual mentor that, you know, very focused, very formal, and limiting to business, there still can be benefit in that. And it can be done with a lot of hijab virtually, like through email, right? It's it doesn't have to be something that you have to pick up the phone and talk to each other or text each other on the phone, but, you know, just something formal. Where it comes to, you know, to email, and a person writes a letter back. And this used to happen in the earlier days in the form of letters. This is how women would, you know, they would write a letter to, and even male students, that's how they used to communicate with their sheikh, right? They would write them a letter, and then they would write them letters back. And as actually a collation of those letters that would form compilations that we call maktubat, right, the maktubat of Majad al-Fisani, the maktubat of Khaja Ma'asum rahmatullah alayhi, and other mashayikh, right, they have their maktubat. That's where those things come from. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala keep us in afia and make roads for all of us to have access to individuals that inspire us and help us become more perfect in our deen and improve ourselves. Wa akhiru da'wana alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.